Now, I don't have much of a text this morning. Just the 21st verse of the 11th chapter of Hebrews. By faith, Jacob, when he was dying, blessed each of the sons of Joseph and worshipped, leaning on the top of his staff. Now, here we are. We have the 11th chapter of Hebrews that involve all these notable people of faith, this history, these testimonies that's given in the Bible that are set forth to be a great company of witnesses to us concerning the fact that the just shall live by faith. And this man, Jacob, whose name was changed to Israel and whose name the whole nation bears, still yet today, a nation over there gathered again in the land called Israel. All it says when it comes to this subject of faith concerning him is this little short, seemingly insignificant verse here. By faith, Jacob, when he was dying, blessed each of the sons of Joseph. How in the world am I going to preach that? Well, here is a question that ought to spark our curiosity concerning the nature of the Bible, the book that it is, that it wastes no words, no time. Everything in it is intensely significant. Why this particular act of Jacob, out of all his history, out of everything that he did, why does that appear here for us? In the 11th chapter of Hebrews, the only one they're going to talk about Jacob's faith. And the only thing that's said about his faith was that he blessed both the sons of Joseph when he was dying and worshipped leaning on his staff. Well, we shall see that it is indeed greatly significant and profitable to us when it sets before us these thoughts. It is one of the hazards when we read biographies of notable Christians that we get somewhat intimidated. I could never attain to that level of Christian spirituality. Or sometimes we get a little bit idolatrous and want to idolize these people who live these great lives of faith and accomplished so much. And we get to where we want to quote them rather than the Bible. And we read about these and we feel ourselves so far back in the boonies, so far back in the woods, we wonder if we have any faith at all. And we see that our lives are so unlike some of those. If we have difficulty identifying with John the Baptist, with Elijah, with Elisha, with Stephen, with Paul, with Enoch who walked with God, and God just took him. If we have trouble saying, do I indeed truly have faith? If the just shall live by faith, we're justified by faith, and this is faith. Have I got any? Well, perhaps if we could not too well identify with some of those, we might find ourselves able to get in the same company with this man, Jacob, for whom God's elect people are named Israel. For you see that Jacob's life, his entire life, I mean the whole thing, and it never occurred to me until I was faced with this question. Why this particular act of faith of his whole life comes up here? That Jacob's entire life is more characterized by unbelief and fleshy scheming than by faith and trust. His life is not characterized by one who is resting in the promises and the almighty faithfulness of God, but it's a life of struggle. I mean from the word go. Struggle, scratching, scheming, digging, fighting, rather than resting. It is characterized in his words and in his what comes forth from the fountain of his heart by more complaint, bellyaching and whining, rather than praise and thanksgiving. Discontent rather than gratitude. Now, I didn't come to you today to slander Jacob, but it is necessary for us to give some significance and meaning to the statement that's brought forth. Here was Jacob, a man of faith. And the one instance that's set forth is illustrated of his faith. So, this man has an extensive history in the Bible. I would weary you very quickly by trying to read and quote all of those passages that have to do with Jacob's life that I want to just mention to you extemporaneously without finding the scriptures. You've got a little time. You'd like to spend them profitably. Perhaps this afternoon or sometime next week, you might like to reread the life of Jacob. Concerning his birth, some of you might remember a phenomenon. When Rachel became pregnant, she had the awfulest commotion going on in her womb. She didn't know what was happening. I mean, it wasn't just ordinarily, you know, a baby kicking a little bit and moving around. But she just had a regular storm going on in her. And she besought the Lord about this. And Isaac besought the Lord about this. And this was the answer that was given. Those says, you've got a pair of boys, a pair of twins in there, and they are struggling. Here it was, the flesh and spirit were already resisting one another and fighting one another in Rachel's womb. Not Rachel, but Rebecca. Excuse me if I get these wrong every once in a while. You'll forgive an old man for his lapses in memory. But says, there will be two nations. And says, the older shall serve the younger. But here was Jacob, even before he was born, was struggling and scrapping and scratching right there in the womb. He's a man of struggle, not rest. After he was born, shortly after he was born, and of course Esau was born first, that made him, of course, to be the firstborn and the heir with a greater blessing. Turns out that's what Jacob was after all along. And he come out hanging on to his brother's heel, and so they named him supplanter. Even then, he was after what Esau had. He wasn't content with himself, what God had given to him. From the word go, he was after everything that Esau had, trying to make somebody out of something. He was a stay-at-home sort of fellow who clung to the security of his mother. Esau was a he-man. He was a hunter. He was a man of the fields. And he was out and going. But Jacob was one who wanted to kind of hang around and polish apples for his mother and make sure nothing got past that he didn't get in on. And then we see his plotting and the taking of Esau's birthright. And it didn't just happen that when Esau came in from hunting that Jacob happened to be cooking a pot of red beans and rice. It didn't just happen he happened to come in about that time. Jacob was watching. He had observed a pattern that Esau would go out, and when he come back in, he about starved to death. And all his life he'd been thinking about how he going to get that birthright. And he'd observed Esau, and he said, you know, I believe if I could catch him hungry enough, I could buy that birthright with a pot of beans. And there he was laying for it. Had it seasoned up real good. And when he came in, this is what he did. He said, oh, I sure would like to have some of that red porridge. Well, he said, tell you what, for your birthright you can have it. Well, what birthright going to do me? I'm about to die. Well, of course, he wasn't about to die. But that's the way a profane man is. He thinks if he doesn't get what he's got to have, he's going to die. And so Jacob was scheming, and he took that. He wasn't trusting God. He had to get it himself. And he wasn't satisfied with that. He knew that his daddy admired and loved his older brother more than he did him. Thought he was kind of a wimp, you know, hanging around his mama all the time. Esau went out hunting deer, and the old man started getting old, and of course Rachel was, you know, his, not Rachel, but Rebecca. Am I right here? She understood what was going on too. And Jacob's fawning on his mother was not wasted. Mama was going to make sure that Jake didn't come in second in this thing. And so she helped him plot and scheme about the thing, so that when Jacob's eyesight, Isaac's eyesight had grown dim and he could not see very well, that they pulled that stunt on him and got not only Esau's birthright, but also Esau's blessing. And then after that happened, he got it. Well enough, he could say, well, you know, I got this by my own scheming. It wasn't a blessing of God that God just gave to me. Which he well might have said, and he have overlooked the providence and the sovereignty of God, which includes our scheming and lying and deceit. But if God now has given him the blessing, and God has seen to it that he got the birthright, he can't trust God to keep Esau from killing him. And so he got to run. This isn't an act of faith. This is an act of unbelief and cowardice. And so he has to run from his brother Esau. Finally, he gets over here, and God has brought him to his uncle, and his uncle hired him. And he's going to give him his wages, kind of on a sharecropping basis. And so what's he going to do? He isn't content to just take whatever befalls him. He got the scheme to get Laban's cattle. And of course, Laban's just crooked as he was. But here is Jacob supposed to be a man of faith. And the things that he did to get Laban's cattle, people sometimes get rather upset about it. I can't see how that would work. Well, it didn't work. The fact that he put striped rods before him to get spotted cattle, and put bare rods before him to get solid colored cattle, I don't have a thing to do whether a calf is born spotted or not. God did that. It wasn't the rods that were set up, but he couldn't see that either. He thought that he was doing it all. Once again, this is not a man of faith. This is a man of scheming and conniving and doesn't trust God for anything. But I'm just marking out and illustrating that this is not a great man of faith. And then when the time came to go back to Canaan, here was a rich man. God blessed him. Did everything that he asked him to do at Bethel. You remember that prayer we just read a little while ago? Boy, that's a great man at a man of faith there at Bethel, wasn't it? Sounds like Peter on the Mount of Transfiguration. He said, whew, boy, I done stumbled into God's house here. Whew, God is in this place and I didn't even know it. How in the world did I wind up here? He thought he had run on to God's house. Right out here in the wilderness, God is right here. Sounds just like Peter at the Mount of Transfiguration wants to build a monument there. But at least he said, this would be a good place to make a deal. Tell you what, Lord, you give me bread to eat, bring me safe again, give me prosperity on my journey and what I'm doing, and bring me safe again to my father's house. He said, you'll be my God, and I'll give you 10% of it. Well, God did all of that, but he, up until this point, he still thought he was going to get killed before he got back home. Somebody had told him Esau had come and got 400 men with him. Oh, he's still mad at me. And so he has to pull all of these stunts and all of this scheming to try to cool off Esau's anger before he met him. And so, he hasn't learned anything yet. Now, there were a few, granted, a few acts of faith on Jacob's life, just like there are in any Christian's life, no matter how weak and faithless he is when it comes to practical things. But those acts of faith are those acts to which he was crowded to. God just crowds him to him, shuts him up in a place. You've got in this particular consideration two kinds of faith. There's a kind of faith that a person can do, a choice he can exercise with no coercion, no urgency in any way, simply because this is the trusting right thing to do and this is the untrusting, unbelieving thing to do, and he chooses the right thing. Then there are other acts of faith where God backs us up into a corner and shuts off every way of escape and fixes us to the point to where we don't have any other choice than to trust God. Just got to. Well, those are the only kind we have in Jacob's greater life. There at Bethel, for instance, that confession of faith that he made, it's a pretty weak one. But what else can you do? There you are. You're running with nothing but your clothes on your back and a sack lunch and nothing ahead. What are you going to do? Well, that's a pretty good place. Say, now, Lord, I'm in a mess here now. I tell you what, if you take care of me, we'll have us something going here. Well, that wasn't a very big act of faith. You know, you can't lose in something like that. You know, no other place to go. Then there was the act of faith at Peniel. And this was at that brook of Peniel when he was going back, and he had already sent his cattle and his camels and his sheep and his oxen and all his possession and even his children and his wives ahead. And he still didn't have any peace and wasn't afraid he was going to get killed when he saw Esau. And the Lord was wrestling with him. This angel of the Lord was wrestling with him. And Jacob refused to let him go. Here he is, he's prevailing with God. Finally, he is wrestling in prayer with God. Why? He still doesn't have any peace or any rest in him. And he won't let God go. Why? Well, it wasn't like that to begin with. God was wrestling with him, and Jacob never would trust him. And so he reached down and touched his thigh and shrank the tissue of him and crippled him. Uh-oh, Jacob lost his last possibility of saving his skin. You see, he got in bad trouble with Esau once before, and he saved himself by running away. Well, he can't run now. He crippled. And so he said, now, Lord, you're going to have to bless me now. I ain't let you go because I can't run anymore. And that's when he changed his name from Jacob to Israel. Also, there came the time when he finally did get back into the land of Canaan, and his sons got him into trouble again, bad trouble. One of the men of Canaan fell in love with Dinah, one of their sisters, his son's sister, Jacob's daughter. And there was quite a ruckus about that. And here the men of Canaan wanted to integrate with the Israelites. And the Israelites said, we'll do this if we can circumcise you like we are. And so they let them circumcise them. And as soon as they got them circumcised, they went in and killed a bunch of them. And Jacob said, oh, you boys have done got me in trouble now. So they're going to kill me. You done made me to stink in the face of the inhabitants of the land. How am I going to live? And God said, spoke to him again. He said, I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to go back to Bethel, where I met God again. Once again, here's an act of faith. Never thought about Bethel until then. Here he is. How am I going to live? He said, I'll go back. God helped me one time before. Maybe he will again. So this is the characteristic of Jacob's life. It is not a type of life that you and I would want to emulate and admire and aspire to. But we also see in this God's chastening rod teaching him. You see, Jacob don't get by with his scheming and conniving. In fact, it gets him absolutely nothing that he can use outside of the blessings and the protection of God. There's the wrath of Esau. He didn't let him get by with that. Esau is ready to kill him. In Genesis 27, we see the predicament that he'd gotten in there in the 27th chapter of Genesis, verse 41, Esau hated Jacob because of the blessing with which his father blessed him. And Esau said in his heart, the days of mourning of my father at hand, and as soon as that's over, I'm going to kill that boy. And the word of Esau, our older son, was told Rebekah, and she sent and called Jacob, her younger son, and said, surely your brother comforts himself concerning by intending to kill you. Now therefore, my son, obey my voice, arise and flee to my brother Laban and Haran. And so we see the chastening rod of God on his sins. He doesn't get by with his sins. He doesn't get by with the deception of Laban. Here he is stealing Laban's cattle. And all the time he's wanting to marry Laban's daughter, Rachel. And so he works 7 years for Laban, for Rachel. I don't know how they worked that deal. Through the night he didn't know what woman he had married until the morning, and behold, it was Leah. And I suspect he thought about those 7 years he's out there working for Rachel, and at all time stealing. And God says, boy, you don't steal. You're not dishonest. And so he had to work 7 more years for Rachel. Also, there's the judgment of God and the chastening hand of God by closing Rachel's womb. But you know that was grievous. You see, a child of God, a genuine child of God, might pull a lot of these unbelieving, deceitful, sinful stunts. But dear friend, you're going to know when the rod falls. Don't you think that he thought when Rachel didn't bring him any children and Leah was having kids all along? You suppose it dawned on him or occurred to him that God's displeased with the way I've been living? Then there was the loss of Rachel, his beloved wife, before he got to Bethlehem. There was his disabling at Peniel. And that is one of the most beautiful pictures of God's chastening rod and his love, that many times, if we will not submit and trust him in any other way, he'll cripple us to the point that we've got to lean on him. And it's a great blessing to be loved of God enough for him to break a leg, put out an eye, cripple us, disable us, disenfranchise us in such a way that we have to start leaning on him and trusting him. Some folks believe God enough he doesn't have to deal that severely with. But if God has to do that, he'll do it. And then we've already mentioned the matter of Shechem and Dinah and the inhabitants of Cana. And then, even in his older years, the loss of his beloved Joseph. Oh, don't you know that was a blow. When those boys came back home and brought that blooded coat of Joseph and said, Daddy, we don't know what happened to him, but we found this old bloody coat. Looked like the ain't, looked like a bear, lion, something, eat him up. Don't you know he mourned? Don't you know he grieved in the loss of Joseph, his beloved, his favorite son? But God wasn't through with him that. Later on, after Joseph was down in Egypt, they run out of food in Canaan. He sent his sons down to Egypt to buy some corn from Egypt. They didn't recognize Joseph. And Joseph demanded that they leave Simeon with him. Put him in jail till they bring Benjamin up there. They had to go back and face Jacob. Where's Simeon? Oh, that man told us that he wanted to see his younger brother. And until we brought that younger brother, they won't let Simeon go. Now we're going to have to take Benjamin back and let him see Benjamin so we can get Simeon out of jail. He said, no, sir, you're not going to take Benjamin. He said, Joseph is gone, Simeon is gone, and now you're going to try to take... No, you're not going to do it. But he did, because the famine continued, and they got hungrier and hungrier and hungrier. And finally, he had to send Benjamin. Are everybody going to starve to death? Oh, he's paying for it. You see, God's chastening hand and God's rod is heavy upon him. And then you know the rest of the story, how they go down there and eventually Jacob goes down himself. All right. here we come to the significance of the statement, this particular statement of Jacob's faith. By faith, Jacob blessed both the sons of Joseph. Now, I remember last week we noted that faith has a prophetic character to it. That is, some things God shows to us and we know. We know we would die 1,000 deaths before we deny it. We know it's so. We don't have any other way of knowing it other than the fact that God has revealed it unto us. We don't know everything, but we know these things. This is the character of Jacob's faith at that time. His prophetic act at this particular time is a free and deliberate and sure. Let me read it to you from Genesis chapter 48 and verse 13 through 20. And see if this sounds like the Jacob of his main lifetime. Genesis chapter 48 and verse 13. Joseph took them both, that is Ephraim and Manasseh. Joseph took them both, Ephraim with his right hand toward Israel's left hand, and Manasseh with his left hand toward Israel's right hand, and brought them near him. Then Israel stretched out his hand, right hand, and laid it on Ephraim's head, who was the youngest, and his left hand on Manasseh's head, guiding his hands knowingly, for Manasseh was the firstborn. See, he had to do this. Now Joseph brought him to him, set up right where he could do this. But Jacob did this. You see this free, deliberate, certain, sure act of faith that he's doing now? Completely out of character for his entire life. And he blessed Joseph and said, God before whom my fathers Abraham and Isaac walked, the God who has fed me. That don't sound like him either. All my life long to this day, the angel who has redeemed me from all evil, bless the lads and let my name be named upon them in the name of my fathers Abraham and Isaac, and let them grow into a multitude in the midst of the earth. Now when Joseph saw that his father laid his right hand on the head of Ephraim, it displeased him. So he took hold of his father's hand to remove it from Ephraim's head to Manasseh's head, and Joseph said to his father, not so, my father, for this one is the firstborn. Put your right hand on his head. But his father refused and said, I know, my son, I know. He also shall become a people, and he also shall be great. But truly his younger brother shall be greater than he, and his descendants shall become a multitude. So he blessed them that day, saying, by you Israel will bless, saying, may God make you as Ephraim and Manasseh. And thus he set Ephraim before Manasseh. You see, this act is now flowing from a man who has finally come to know and listen to and obey God. The significant words in our text are these. When he was a-dying and leaning on his staff, did this man, Jacob, ever come to rest and believe and trust in God? Yeah. When? When he was dying, did he ever come to really worship God? You don't see it in any of his life. Yeah, when? When he was leaning on his staff and nearly dead. You see that? Now the significance of what he did is not lost too much. God always rejects the firstborn and raises up the second. He rejected Cain, accepted Abel. He rejected Esau, chose Jacob. Here he rejects Manasseh, raises up Ephraim. He rejected Saul, raised up David. The first man is of the earth, earthy. The second man is the Lord from heaven. If we do not die to our first life, our firstborn, then we never will have the new birth, the new life, the new creation which is in Christ Jesus. That's a principle set forth. Also, it makes it possible for God to take out of those 12 sons one tribe, Levi, separate them for the priesthood, and still leave 12 tribes. It also gives Jacob, or rather Joseph, a double portion. And Ephraim becomes synonymous with the non-spiritual mass of Israel. When the kingdom was divided, Israel was to the north, which was called often Ephraim. Judah was to the south, which were often called Jews. Now we have Ephraim, or the mass of Israel, the multitude, but the remnant, those that is that belong to the southern kingdom, separated unto the tribe of Judah, that we now call them Jews, come from the word Judah. The whole of Israel, as a mass, as apostate, rejected. But God has saved and brought out a remnant that we call Jews, those who are submitted to the Lion of Judah, our Lord Jesus Christ. And so Jacob finally worshipped. When? When all his strength was gone, and he was dying, leaning on his staff. You remember what he said when he came down into Egypt, and Jacob was brought before Pharaoh, and Pharaoh said, "How old are you, old man?" Here's what Jacob said. "Here's how old I am. Few and evil have been my days, and I still ain't as old as my father's, and I had a rough time of it all the way." Yeah, before the king of Egypt, does he give a testimony to God? No, he says, "You know, I had that many days. I know, near as old as my fathers were, had a hard time of it too. Few and evil have been my days." Whining, complaining. But here, he's worshiping the God who has fed me, the God who has kept me, the God who has... Oh, you read those. This man is worshiping God. He ceased from his struggling, and now he's resting. He stopped his scheming, and now he's simply proclaiming, standing with his feet solid on the rock of ages, declaring what shall be and what shall surely come. Instead of whining, he's praising and exulting in God. Now, what can we learn from this? Well, we learn from this that many of God's true blood-bought children are very weak in faith all their lives. That bother you? Very weak in faith all their lives. They evidence very little growth and bear very little fruit. And the Bible tells us, "Him that is weak in the faith, receive you, and not to doubtful disputes." I don't believe he's saved. Yeah, well, all he needs to do is just get saved. Well, yeah, he's no Christian. He'd be like me if he was a Christian. Many of God's genuine children, very weak in faith, and bring forth little fruit. They have a few acts of faith, but those acts of faith that they have, they just have to get pushed up in a corner and crowded where they can't do anything else but trust God. They just have to. Sure can't brag nothing about that. Well, what makes us think if we see people like that who are so weak in faith, and it seems like before they ever trust God or believe God for anything, they just have to be put in a place where they got to, and they don't bring forth a lot of fruit? How do you know they're lost? They're not Christians. Well, what makes you think they're not just lost? Well, that could be. We have warrant, however, to believe them Christians because, for one, they don't turn back. They keep on. They continue gathering with God's people. They look around and say, "I don't see what y'all are so excited about, but I'm going to stay around. They don't run me off." They just doggedly keep pressing on. They don't quit. They don't give up. They don't know much. But they know enough that they can't turn back. They keep on. They don't renounce the faith. Also, we have warrant to believe that they're Christians because God deals with them as Christians. He protects them, even though they don't give him much glory for it. He comforts them. It seems like they're going to be almost wiped out, almost washed out. But God comes and encourages them, keeps them in. He protects and delivers and blesses. He chastens and corrects them in his love. And they know it! And he does. He crowds them to faith. He puts them in situations where it looks like they're going to just sink. I mean, they're just not going to make it. And like Peter, "Lord, I perish!" And he reaches out and picks you up. God treats them like that. So therefore, we who are ashamed of our spiritual performances may hope in the God whose salvation is by grace through faith and not of works. We too may have hope, sound hope of final victory. We may not be leaning on our staff yet. We may not be dying yet. We may not have exhibited much growth, much fruit, much faith. But we have hope that we will. God will bring all his elect to trust him perfectly. Let us stand.